whatever it is, where people are having art and it doesn't have anybody who looks like you. And that, I think, is a very visceral reaction to feeling that not only does this art represent me, but it's, you know, it's telling my story.
Hello and welcome to episode 14 of Lo-Fi Podcast. I am John Wentz, recording conversations with artists, musicians, and filmmakers, now from my flat in Paris, France. Yes, we are on quarantine here in Paris. Few updates. First, going on here in Paris, in case anybody's wondering, we did go on an official lockdown yesterday starting at 12 noon. We are restricted for what they're saying is a minimum of 15 days. Many are speculating that that's going to go further, but I don't want to get into that and cause some panic. We are allowed to go out. You have to fill out the, I believe it is the attestation de déplacement dérogatoire, which is a little paper permission slip so you can go to the store. I don't know, go to work, whatever it is. So I am holing up in the flat, working digitally and recording podcasts. I hope everyone else is doing well out there, staying safe and keeping busy with the quarantine. It's a good time to think about supporting artists and musicians, something I've been very concerned with. I see a lot of musicians having to cancel tours. I'm missing a few out here in Paris, bands that I wanted to see. And I know as a professional artist and many of you listening, we're having a tough time with our art. So if you can support artists, buy prints, buy paintings, and buy albums. It's never been easier with digital downloads. I've seen things like Bandcamp, Bandcamp.com is not going to take a percentage of any sales. So all 100% of sales will go to the artist. So if you can afford it, this is a good time to support the arts, all of the arts, because I think we can all agree the greatest issue coming out of this is going to be probably the economic once all said and done. I know for myself, all the shows that I had planned for up through summer have been canceled. That makes me wonder how long I can continue to do the podcast, among other things. And I know I'm not the only one in this situation. So I hope everybody makes it through this. I know we're going to. And support each other. Reach out, email, message, call. With that, my guest this week is my good friend Nidhi Chinnani. Nidhi Chinnani is a freelance illustrator, cartoonist, and writer born in Calcutta and raised in suburban Southern California. After completing her undergrad literature degree at the University of California at Santa Cruz, Nidhi pursued a career in nonprofits. The desire to draw kept pulling her away, and in 2008, she enrolled in art school, only to drop out a year later. In 2009, she began completing one illustration every day of the week. She called this Everyday Love and developed her narrative style and voice with 3 years of daily practice. Thus began her art career and business. Her debut graphic novel, Pashmina, was released by First Second Books in fall 2017. It received starred reviews in the School Library Journal, Publishers Weekly, and was reviewed in the New York Times. In March of 2019, the film adaptation of Pashmina with Netflix was announced. Gurinder Chadha is set to direct. In this episode, we talk about Nidhi's journey as an illustrator and serendipitous beginnings as a graphic novelist, comics as a platform for marginalized voices, her upcoming film adaptation of her graphic novel Pashmina on Netflix, and much more. So without further delay, Nidhi Chinnani. Nice, nice. How are you, Nidhi? It's been way too long.
It has been. I don't even remember the last time we talked. I don't know. It's probably been... Well, I know I was in school around 2009. I can't have been over 10 years. Can it?
I think it has. I was going to say it's been somewhere between 8 and 10 years.
Okay. That's a long time.
I know. It goes by quick, huh? And you look exactly the same. You look wonderful. And you sound the same. I mean, everything's amazing. And now you have this amazing life.
I mean, when we were hanging out 10 years ago, you were my teacher and you were telling me how not to make everything brown.
That's right. And you know what's funny is I remember, so something that I'm really excited to talk to you about mm-hmm. is, and I hope this doesn't come off in any way a negative thing, but I remember that specifically. And I also remember, for some reason, a conversation we had, maybe was it anatomy class? Did we have anatomy?
Yes.
And I don't know if you were dissatisfied with the program. You were unhappy about something about the school, I think. Am I remembering incorrectly?
No. I think I was, you know, being an older student. So I went to art school when I was, how old was I? I don't know, 26, 27. And so I think part of it was just that I knew what I wanted to do, or at least I thought I knew what I wanted to do then. And I felt like,
yeah,
maybe the school wasn't getting me there, and everything was focusing so much on kind of a more traditional idea of what art could look like. And I was definitely, you know, I was in the illustration or second BA illustration program, but I still felt like I was being taught how to draw in this way yeah. that I didn't want to draw. I don't know. So I think that's probably what it was. Although I do have to say that, you know, in retrospect, it might have been that I was just not ready. You know, I wasn't there yet in terms of like learning the things that they wanted to teach me. I just, my skill set wasn't there yet. Whereas now my drawings changed so much since then that anatomy is something that I probably now would benefit from greatly. But I think, you know, at the time it was just probably a lot of discomfort, you know, in realizing that your skill set is where it's at and seeing all these people who are above you or more comfortable with kind of growing in that way. And I was just not.
But the only reason I bring that, I mean, it could have been any of those things, but for me watching you, and it was so great to see you online and when we reconnected on social media, because this is just from my point of view, it was that attitude or that feeling that was like, when I saw you growing and doing your thing, I was like, I remembered back in that moment talking to you in the classroom and thinking in my head, this student is going to kick ass. Like she's the tenacity and the knowing what you want. Like I just had this feeling like she's going to do amazing. And because I've seen other students that were like that back then. And then friends that I have, it's that, I don't know, like you were describing, it's just, it could be a multitude of things, but it just felt like you had a certain vision or I don't know what it is, but it was nice to see you grow into what you've done. I think is what I'm trying to say.
Thank you.
No.
It's interesting to hear that, actually.
How so?
It's a nice, it's a nice reminder because I teach now in a Master's of Fine Arts comics-focused program at the
Congratulations, by the way. That's awesome.
Thanks. Yeah, it's great. I teach once a year. It's what my schedule can allow, and it's mostly online, which is in and of itself a challenge. But, you know, after this is, I think, going on my fourth year doing it, you know, the first 2 years I really felt like I was just trying to figure it out, and now I feel like I'm in a good groove. It's still challenge because I have so many work commitments and I travel a lot for work, but it's nice to hear that because I have students like that myself. You know, I have students who have, you know, they have like a very specific yeah. way of thinking about how they want to create art, and I just really see myself as kind of like a I don't know. I don't see myself really as a teacher so much as a guide. I'm there to answer the questions. But the biggest part, I feel like, of being a good teacher mm-hmm. or a solid teacher, and what I've realized over the years is being a cheerleader. So much, I think, of doing art and doing something that doesn't have any specific way to achieve the goal that you want to reach. You know, everybody gets to where they want to go in so many different ways, and there's really no, you know, it's not like becoming a doctor, you know, and I think that it becomes one of those things yeah. that, you know, if you don't see kind of immediate results or you don't understand the path of people around you, can end up, you know, being not as supportive, or it becomes challenging to find that pool of support that keeps you motivated to keep at your dream, you know, and even calling it a dream, I think, is complicated. So I think that, you know, that's a good reminder to just, you know, even if somebody who has specific ideas, to just to let them go with that, you know. I think it's great.
That's a tough one. I mean, mm-hmm. I don't know how, because you're teaching at CCA, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So it's probably, I know at least from the fine art department, it's very different than something like the academy where we were at.
Yeah.
How is the illustration department? Because you're in illustrations concentrating on comics, correct?
Yeah, but I'm really just in the comics department. Because it's a master's program, we have our own department head. Yeah, I don't really interface that much with illustration. I've talked to the illustration department here and there.
Okay.
But my schedule doesn't allow me to take on more than I already have. But there's a lot of freedom. There's definitely a lot of freedom. I don't think that's the same at the academy.
No, there isn't. And what do you teach within the comics?
It's called a studio class. So it's mentored studio. So essentially it is, it's a very hands-off mentorship type situation. So I give them a couple assignments, more than a couple assignments through the semester, but a lot of it is really commenting on the work that they're submitting, the work that they've already done, and being in conversation with them. So I don't meet with them weekly. I do meet with them a couple times in the semester and just try to see specifically, because it's a mentorship, what their specific issues, or not issues, but their specific goals are and challenges are, and try to come up with either resources, special guests, that kind of thing. And so, you know, just being a resource to help them get to the next stage in their comics path, whatever that might be. Because some of them want to teach. Most of them want to make their own graphic novels.
This may be a really stupid question.
But there are no stupid questions.
Do you see? I'm just curious because of because my background. I mean, I was always that's why I started drawing was comics. So my first love was comics. But then it was a rare thing. You were a dork if you were into comics. But I'm wondering, has there been like a spike in people wanting to create comics since the whole translation to cinema?
I think that helps a lot. I think more than anything within the comics industry, what we're seeing right now is a rise of marginalized voices. So, you know, primarily, like when we were growing up, it was kind of that superhero stuff, primarily written by men and drawn by men. And so there's been a huge kind of shift now. We're seeing a lot of queer people, a lot of women, and a lot of shifting away from the superhero narratives and just the comics. I think the comics offerings are getting diverse. You know, there's really just a lot of comics, and it's being used much more in schools. And so that comes with its own, I mean, each time something that's disruptive to the system, there's going to be some pushback to that. So there are, of course, educators and parents who don't want their kids to read comics. But there's been also educators and librarians and parents who are very pro, whatever my kid is reading, just let them read. I think it's an exciting time, and it's still also a challenging time. You know, it's always kind of a mix.
Yeah, I can imagine. Yeah. And when, I forget when you were back to the academy, I want to get a little bit back to your starting. Mm-hmm. You were in illustration, but did you know then your focus was comics?
I took a comics class with Dan Cooney.
Oh, okay.
And I wanted to do it. And as soon as I left the academy, so I dropped out, art school dropout. I dropped out. I was basically like, oh, John's not teaching any more classes, so I'm out.
Thanks.
I mean, did I take three classes with you? I feel like I took. I was only there for two semesters. I took you both semesters.
So I had you for both semesters. That's awesome. Two semesters. Yeah. Wow.
Why is that wow?
Because it's just amazing to me. I love seeing, I guess just because where I'm at now is just just doing art. I'm constantly impressed, and I guess I want to hear more about people with that kind of motivation. Because it's two semesters and look what you've done. It's to me, that's amazing. I love the inner drive. I love the people that need to get something out. You know, and we both know, at least my experience in art school was, it was a vast majority of just people who, no fault to anyone else, but it wasn't very motivating for a lot of people. They just didn't know what they were doing. Art school was the thing, I don't know.
Right.
That rich kids did or something. So I just think it's fantastic.
I think that part of it was because I was so bad at it. you know.
Do you think, really?
Yeah. I think, you know, I went, so this is, I don't know if you had a lot of students like this, but part of the reason I went to the academy was because they didn't have a portfolio review. I mean, that's one of the things that I loved about it, because I knew I wanted to do art, but I also was very aware of the fact that my skills were rudimentary. And I was never that kid. You know, one of the things about being where I'm at now is I interact with a lot of students and a lot of kids who are hearing that message from their entire community that you're the artist of the community. You're so good at it. And, you know, how do I encourage them? I'm like, you're doing great. I was not that. And I was into it, but I never had any encouragement whatsoever. And I went to art school and I still didn't have that because, I mean, when I got to the academy, even though, you know, without that portfolio review, there was a lot of like kind of, you have a, I think, a much wider mix of entry-level skills than you would, let's say, if you went to CalArts, right? So I think that that was good, but even still, you know, being 27 and art school and not being very good, I realized even more. I think being in art school made me recognize, one, how many avenues there were available to be a professional artist and to do this as a job, which was amazing and explosive for me. Like, it was really, you know, I went in being which is what I do now anyways, but I want to make books. But then when I got there, I realized that as a freelance artist, you could do so many things. And that was really great for me, at least in the beginning when I was, you know, kind of learning my skills and doing some freelance stuff. But I think the other part of it is that even though there was no portfolio review, there are all these kids in the academy that were amazing. And so I knew if I was going to get anywhere, I had to work 100 times harder because I was nowhere close to amazing. You know, like I really knew that I had to put in so much time because I sucked, you know?
Yeah, no, I actually can't remember. I was just talking to somebody about this because that was similar to my situation. Cause when I went in, I was terrible. I was so bad. And I was always nearly the worst person in every class, but it made me work 100 times harder, and I'm so thankful for that because most of the people, there were a few that it seemed to come to them very easy, but they didn't do anything with it. A lot of people just stopped painting or something, you know, after they graduated. But my thing was I always had to work. I felt at least twice as hard as everybody else just to get mid-level, not even to get, you know. And that's still how I feel now. I mean, I have to, you know, I'm not that good. I have to work really hard.
That's not true at all. But it's kind of, I mean, I wonder if you said this in class, but I wonder why, if that's why I felt so inclined to be in your class, because I maybe related to that so much. But I find that just, I mean, even when you were teaching us, I was just in awe of your skills. I still am. I still look at your work and it's just beautiful. And I've seen it grow and change, obviously, from, you know, 10 years ago. And so that's fascinating to me. And I wonder, you know, I mean, you think about this. I don't know if you think about this stuff a lot, but I always wonder what makes me be where I am now versus, and I still am in contact with some of the people that I went to the academy with who are not doing anything with art. And they were great. They were far more skilled than I was and probably still are.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, everybody's story is different. I think the person I was talking with, we were kind of chalking up at least our experience, was that I think part of it was that when you have to work for something, it means that much more to you. And I think, you know, that's just one part of the soup, so to speak. It's like once you just have that drive, and I saw that in you, and obviously it's there, you know, you just want to make art. And that's how I was, and friends that I have now. But then also we weren't that good, but for some reason we had to do it. So it's like, okay, man, now I got to work really hard. So you earned that. So it, I think that kind of helps that drive. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't know.
No, I think there's something to that. I think there's definitely something to, I mean, cause it's, I feel like you're trying to prove it to yourself too, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. But, so I'm curious cause I'm sorry, I'm going to be going over your whole story cause I'm so fascinated, since I last saw you at school. So then when you dropped out, what happened?
So I dropped out and I knew that I was still not very good, but I had gotten a pretty good understanding of, you know, light and shadow and color. And I feel like, you know, if I could attribute at least the basics, I didn't even know, right? And when I went into the academy, I was just like, I really like to draw. I really like to experiment with paint, and I don't know anything else. And so, you know, taking some of those classes and really kind of focusing on value and all those things, even though at the time, even when I left school, I would say I didn't really understand it yet, because I do feel like it's one of those things you have to use a lot to get a full, complete understanding of it. I ended up emailing this artist that I really liked, and working being in air quotes, but working in a shared artist studio. And so basically they saw me as an intern who didn't actually have any purpose to being there, just being around other artists. And so that studio had all four of them were animators. One of them is still, she's actually one of my best friends. Her name's Lila Warren. So I met her, you know, like 8-9 years ago. And she was doing animation freelance. And then a couple of the other people were working for, kind of freelancing for bigger studios. And they've now all gone on to working for them full time. And so I just wanted to be in that environment and see what working artists were doing. And so I don't know if this would happen now, but I'm sure it does. You know, people create mentorships, or people kind of try to help each other out, I think, within the artist community, because it is one of those situations where if you don't have somebody who's willing to say, yeah, you can, let me teach you how I did this thing, because there's no formal way to learn it. I did that for, I think, about a year or two, and that was, or probably 2 years. And during that time period, I thumbnailed out a memoir that will never see the light of day, but it did its job, and its job was to get me an agent. So it got me my first agent, and that was because of somebody in the studio he now is teaching actually at RISD. His name is Andy Restaino. So Andy was in that studio, and I was just going there every day, doing a daily drawing every morning, and I emailed that daily drawing out to, initially my mailing list was just family and friends. I started it out, you know, in 2009, and I said, I want to get better at art, so I'm going to send you an email every single day of a drawing that I completed. A complete illustration is what I wanted to challenge myself to do, a complete full-color illustration every single day. And so I was kind of basically asking my friend and family community to keep me accountable. And that way, if I was just doing it for myself, I knew I could just, you know, for myself, I could potentially not show up. But if I knew my community was waiting for this drawing or would check in on me, then I felt more responsible to it. And so that accountability was there. So anyways, I ended up doing that for 3 years. By the end of the first year, I had requests for prints.
Wow.
So end of the first year of daily drawing practice, amazing. You know, I sucked. And it's all actually still on my blog. You could go back to like 2009, find the original drawings I did back then. And I have people. And so essentially, like, what happened over the course of that first year is that people started forwarding those drawings to other people that they knew. I think you'd like this or whatever. And then people would email me and say, can you add me to your mailing list? My mailing list was just one large carbon copy, like that I would copy and paste every morning. And then eventually, you know, I made it into a Google group. And so that grew over a 3 year period of time. I opened an Etsy shop by the following year. And then in conjunction with that, I was thumbnailing out this memoir. So I think it was within that first year out of school that I finished the memoir. I sent it around. Then I was like, okay, I need to get a publisher. But somebody in the studio, it might have been Andy, said, you know, I know Gene Yang, who, if you know who Gene Yang is, he is an amazing, amazing cartoonist. And, you know, maybe Gene Yang's agent would be interested in representing you. Here, let me do an introduction. So Andy introduced me to Gene Yang via email, which I'm sure Gene and I know each other now, but which is crazy to say, given this whole story. But so I had this memoir, and I mean, I think if I opened it up now, which I refuse to do, it'd be embarrassing to see it, because,
why?
You know, I think that it was, such basic comics, you know, like I didn't really know what I was doing, whereas like I now feel like I kind of know what I'm doing with comics. I know much more than I did then, but I sent it to, so Jean responded and said, here's my agent's email. Tell her I sent you. And I was like, but you haven't, I had no attachment, John. There was nothing. He didn't know me from anybody.
Yeah.
But because Andy vouched for me, he said, sure, contact my agent and say that I sent you. And having Jean's endorsement meant that the agent actually opened the attachment of my thumbnail memoir. And then within a week, I had an agent.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah. I mean, nothing happened with that memoir, but just having her gave me this confidence that she saw something in my thumbnail manuscript that meant that I maybe knew what I was doing.
Yeah, that's very encouraging. Man, and I wonder, too, as you're saying that, like, that's such a great idea of creating that email list. And I'm wondering how much of a part of, like you're saying, there's the accountability. Mm-hmm. But I always remember, one of the things I took away from school is I remember finishing an entire body of work. And that's when Kevin Moore is my teacher. And I remember being so proud of this, just completing a body of work. And at my critique, the first thing, and I think it was probably the only thing he said, he's like, okay, now you're half done. And I was like, what? Are you crazy? What do you mean? These 20 paintings. He's like, no, now you have to get it in a gallery and have people look at it. That's the other half of what you're doing. So that, I wonder how much of that for you, that's having an audience, sending it out, making sure it gets out there was also part of that, you know, keeping you doing it.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely think that so one of the things, I still miss this now. If you do a daily practice like that for 3 years, you end up having kind of like this back and forth relationship with the people who've been receiving your emails. So I stopped that. And I think going on probably around the sixth year, I would still pick it up here and there. I would sometimes do watercolors, or I would do something else because I missed it. I missed sending something out every single day and getting that immediate reaction. This was pre-Instagram and all that stuff. So, and people would email me. People would say, oh, I love this one. Or, you know, I sent this to all these people. And these are people I didn't know. And I still, to this day, in fact, somebody just invited me to some conference. And in the message, she was like, I've been part of your mailing list since the early, you know, time. So I would especially love to, so you know, cool. Yeah. So, I mean, it ended up having a pretty decent reach. And people knew you because, or people knew me because they were getting an email from me every single day that had no agenda. My initial reason, I mean, eventually some of the stuff became prints. But initially I was just like, I want to draw. And I want to complete a full illustration every day. And the message that I shared behind it, which is something I still stand by, is I just want to make art that makes people happy. And so...
Okay, I was going to ask what these illustrations were. Mm-hmm. Like, what was the content of them?
So I started calling... I used to have this whole kind of, I guess, explanation. And I even said this before I went to the Academy of Art, which was, you know, when I look at art, it makes me feel, and it makes me feel connected. It makes me think things. It takes me away from stress and, you know, just all the emotions that art brings up in us. And I just wanted to be able to create things that did the same. And so I also feel like, and I think that, you know, I said this back then and I feel this now much more, is that we are surrounded constantly by messages of stress and negativity.
Yes,
And I wanted to remind people that every day, probably multiple times a day, right in front of your eyes, you're probably missing it because you're looking at your phone, there are moments of beauty. There are moments of connection. There are amazing things, and we just miss it. We spend so much of our energy focused on the negativity. And so I started calling my work and the daily emails Everyday Love.
Okay, I was going to ask if that was what it was. Yeah. I remember that.
So my kind of, theme or motto or whatever is that, you know, every day has moments of love. And so I wanted to capture those and kind of use the art as a reminder to pay attention.
And when did you, so those were just the single illustrations. And now, see, we're already at 30 minutes. I'm like, oh my God, there's so much to talk about. and when did you start developing then or getting interested in story format?
I would say that it was around the 2 year mark that so I'd been doing the daily drawings for 2 years. I'd done craft shows and comic book conventions and, you know, showing my illustration work, getting some freelance work here and there, but I was really never good at securing freelance. I was really only good at being my own boss and selling my work. And so I sold a lot of prints and a lot of cards. And a lot of that had to do with like kind of like being out there and getting into shops. And that's all changed, or that's changed a lot now. But my objective also in, you know, creating connections and sharing that everyday love was also making sure that I was creating illustrations that told mm-hmm. a story. And what I like to say is that in the 2 years' time, I got kind of not, I wouldn't say frustrated, but I'm trying to think of a different word, but I got itchy. I guess I was itchy to tell a longer story.
And that's feeling limited?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Okay.
I wonder, do you ever feel like that when you're painting? Do you feel like limited by size or space or, I don't know, is it the same?
Yeah, I do. Well, and I'm specifically really interested in this because that's been kind of my, you know, you have your themes at mm-hmm. certain points in your life. And this thing of storytelling is constantly coming up in my life. And I'm trying to find a better way in just single paintings to do that. And I've been going, for myself, like going back to a lot of books that I love or comics. I've been going back to all my old comics that I really love. So I'm mm-hmm. interested for somebody like you who is a legitimate storyteller, that transition and why.
Yeah. So I think it's just that longer narrative. You know, the illustrations that I had this experience multiple times. I would go out and I would do a craft show or a comic book convention and somebody would come up to my booth and they would start flipping through the artwork. So I had like prints and kind of like, it would be like flipping through records. Right. And they would flip through and it actually is terrible, but it ended up becoming kind of this like joke between my husband and I, because almost every single time people will be flipping through and start crying.
Really?
And he was like, I thought your art was supposed to make people happy. it's that emotional reaction.
That's cool.
It was really wonderful. Also, it made me feel like crap in the moment. He's like, I don't really want to make you guys cry. But part of it was people seeing themselves represented for the first time.
Yeah.
That happened a lot. I draw a lot of brown girls. I draw a lot of mixed race couples. I draw a lot of brown families. And so people would, you know, you could walk through a whole comic book convention or craft fair or stationery store, whatever it is where people are having art and it doesn't have anybody who looks like you.
Yeah.
And that I think is a very visceral reaction to feeling that not only does this art represent me, but it's telling my story. So I think that was something that also made me think, you know, I really want to be able to tell this story in a longer number, you know, in a larger way. And so I had started to, you know, and I had that memoir and I'd reworked it to the point where I didn't want to do it anymore. I also had met cartoonists in my path of doing comic book conventions and talked to people who had done memoirs and realized that when you put your life out there, that's all you talk about. And so I had a very traumatic and abusive upbringing. And so I realized that if I was to do that, I would end up living kind of in that and talking about it a lot. And so I just kind of put that to the side. And then I started thinking about fiction. And I mean, I'm a big reader. You know, I've tracked all my reading on Goodreads. So I like read about roughly 70 to 80 books a year. And that's down since I have a family now. But, it made sense for me, I think. You know, it's kind of like how you say you're going back to the comic books you loved and the books you loved, and storytelling is something that comes up for you. It kept coming up for me, too. And so I felt like, just like I was pulled to art, even though I had no skill set, I was pulled to story. But I think that my skill set in that is that I do have a literature degree. So I studied literature.
I didn't know that, I don't think.
Yeah, My first, or my only degree, my degree is in literature from UC Santa Cruz, and I love books. And so I felt like I always wanted to be an author, but the way that I ended up becoming an author wasn't exactly what I thought would happen. You know, I never thought that I would be a comic book author.
It's so serendipitous right. that it came together. Yeah. So if anybody, okay, so first thing I have to think about is, I don't know, my listener base, is that familiar with you or your work? So going back to what you're talking about, representing people of color, because your background is, I don't know if you were born in India, but your parents were from India.
So my parents were born in India. I was born in India, but I came here when I was 4 months old.
Okay.
So people self decide whether or not, people always tell me what I am, whether I'm first generation or not, whatever. It's all like, people will tell you lots of things about your own identity. But I was born there. And because my parents, so my dad's entire family immigrated to Southern California. And so I grew up in a really big Indian community. The thing about growing up with immigrant parents is, I think this is fairly common, but I don't speak for all immigrant children, or even immigrant Indian children, you know, whatever it is. But, you know, you tend to stay with your community. So I like to say, even though I didn't grow up in India, like, everything that we did was Indian. You know, all the people that we hung out with were Indian. All of our weekends were full of Indian festivals and gatherings. And so, you know, I definitely felt very connected to my identity as an Indian American. But also, there was that same kind of feeling of, like, being neither here nor there. I wasn't really fully Indian because I wasn't growing up in India, and I wasn't fully American because I'm brown. And, you know, I eat different food and, you know, just all those kinds of very stereotypical feelings of being in two worlds at the same time.
Yeah, no, I can completely relate to that because my mom, she immigrated from the Philippines. Mm-hmm. And when I was growing up, I grew up in a town called Earth City, Fremont. It was pretty multicultural. But I spent a lot of time with my grandparents when I was younger. And I can't remember exactly why. I think it was babysitting in the morning or something. So I grew up like eating rice for breakfast and fish and all this stuff. And in my mind's eye, I was very Asian. And I remember this time in school, it was in grade school, like fifth grade maybe. And the teacher, I mean, this is something that could never fly these days, but for some reason the PE teacher put us in ethnic groups.
Wow.
You know, like basketball, you have shirts and skins. She put us everybody and tell them, not go in your group, you know. And so you had the Hispanics were in one, the whites were other. I went with the Asian kids, and I remember her like looking at me. She's like, are you sure you're in the right place? I was like, yeah, Filipino. And she moved me over to the Hispanic kids.
Oh my God.
So I had that same feeling of like, in my mind's eye, I've always felt Asian. I used chopsticks before forks, but I didn't belong, you know, in the Asian culture. Mm-hmm. So it's a very weird thing growing up.
Yeah. I think that for anybody who finds themselves, I mean, I'm raising a mixed child myself. It's like that, you try to understand your world the way that people are trying to make you fit into it in a way that makes sense. You know, it's that categorization that you are fitting into this category. But the truth of the matter is that categorization is really just a way for your brain to organize things, but doesn't really work with humans. It just doesn't. We're just too complicated, right? We're so complicated.
Yeah, no, I 100% agree. Yeah. So when, because I have your Instagram open. I was checking it out earlier. What was the first, so you had Everyday Love, and then when you start exploring this, your background, your upbringing, what was the first comic that went into story format where you were kind of pulling from your life?
So I did a few kind of really short, funny autobio stuff, but honestly, and this is kind of maybe, so one of the things that I do as a teacher is tell people to focus on short stories, and at the same time, to be fully, you know, kind of transparent and honest, my biggest my first real comics work was Pashmina, which is my book. You know, like the book
Pashmina?
That I sold. Yeah, Pashmina is the book that I sold to First Second, came out in 2017, was optioned by Netflix last year. And so,
congratulations.
Thank you. You know, the advice that I give is not the advice that I lived, but... because I had a very I would say that the situation that I had with Pashmina was pretty unique in that, and I was told this by my agent, which is that my publisher for Second took on kind of like projects that needed more support very infrequently, but maybe like one or two projects a year. And so when my editor decided to sign on, he knew that I would need a lot of support in figuring out, you know, paneling and pacing and all this stuff. So he was basically my mentor during that whole process. And I still now am not sure why, but I know that in the, so I had kind of like, before they acquired Pashmina, I had done 8 drafts of my manuscript. And he kept pushing me and, you know, kind of giving me feedback. And I think in that process of seeing how I was willing to change, take feedback, apply it, he, at least this is my assumption, we have a great relationship now, but I've never asked him, like, what did you see back then? You know, but, you know, I assume that in that back and forth, he saw that I could take in the feedback and apply it in a way that he had faith that I could, you know, do a book, even though I had never done anything even close to that before. So then it took me about 4 years to make Pashmina. I mean, I was doing other stuff as well, but, you know, Pashmina is 167 pages, and I probably do every single page in there 4 to 5 times.
Wow.
Because I was messing up so much.
Yeah. And how much of the story is that entire story you're pulling from your own experience?
It's not a memoir because, okay, so Pashmina is a story about an Indian American girl named Priyanka Das who finds a magical Pashmina shawl, and when she puts it around her shoulders, it transports her to a fantasy version of India. And so the, I would say a good portion of the book is black and white, but when she puts the Pashmina on, it goes to full color, kind of a Wizard of Oz effect, I guess. Yeah. The relationship that Priyanka has with her mom and some of the uncle auntie stuff, that is drawn from my life, but it's fiction.
Right. It's okay. Yeah. That's more of what I meant. I knew it wasn't a memoir, but I mean, as somebody who's not a writer, I've only done very basic writing classes. And I was just wondering, even like things like that with metaphor. I mean, I remember writing certain things where like that, where I realized that, you know, if I create some kind of metaphor, like, you know, something, a magic cape or something like that, it was me dealing with a situation in a way to get out of it mentally, you know what I mean? Or emotionally. So yeah. I don't know if any of that, because you're speaking about your childhood, you had a, you know, a difficult upbringing.
No, none of that's a factor in Pashmina. It's really her trying to understand her identity. So her mom, without giving it away, her mom is very close-lipped about India and why she left India, and you realize why later, that she's just trying to protect her. But so, but Priyanka wants to know. She wants to know where she came from. She wants to know all the wonderful, beautiful things about India. And then, you know, kind of halfway through the book, she ends up going there. So.
And when would, what was the feedback? Like, when did you start getting feedback, realizing that this was connecting with people? And how was that?
Oh, I mean, the thing is that, you know, the book comes out and I mean, the feedback was pretty immediate. And also they do send out, you know, kind of preview copies. So I did get some advanced, you know, reactions. But I think the other thing about it is that unlike a prose novel, you can probably read Pashmina in 45 minutes. It took me 4 years. It will take you 45 minutes to read. It's a comic. And so, you know, I've had people wait in a signing line, you know, like autographing line or whatever. And by the time they get up to get the book signed, they're like, I read it in line.
Oh, that's amazing.
So yeah, and then they tell you what they think. And so, you know, it was pretty immediate. And then, you know, it came out, what now, 2.5 years ago. And I still get people messaging me all the time, which is wonderful. You know, it's still out there, still impacting. Yeah.
Oh, really man, nice. That is so cool. Is that something, when you were writing it, were you imagining any of that? Like, were you worried about who this was going to connect with, or did you have any of that in mind as you were going along?
I think the thing that I worried the most about and the thing that I thought the most about is creating characters from my own limited knowledge of what it is to be Indian American, and how then people would take that limited knowledge that I have, that I've put into my character, and apply it with a large brush to everybody that they know.
Kind of creating a stereotype.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you know, many authors have talked about this. It's like, you know, one character is not a monolith, and really have to read multiple stories from any group to really understand them and talk to people. And so I think that was mostly what I was going through my mind. It wasn't really, oh, people are going to love this and they're, you know, this is so great and I can't wait to hear what people think about this. There were definite moments in there. There's some things that I put in that are specific to LA. You know, I grew up in Southern California that I thought, oh, I can't wait till somebody notices this location that I put or this freeway exit or whatever. But those were pretty few and far between. Most of it was just really stressful.
Oh, man, that's too bad.
But on the flip side, the new book that I'm working on, all I can think about is, oh my God, people are going to love this and people are going to love that. So yeah, I built up to that.
What's the new book?
The new book is called Jukebox. It's out in the beginning of next year, spring 21. And it's about two Muslim American girls who find a jukebox in an attic in San Francisco. And when they put on records, it takes them back in time.
Oh, that's awesome. That's the one you just posted the cover for, right?
It's not the cover. It's the title page.
Or not the cover.
But yeah, I did. Yeah. And I was just, it was like one of those things, you know, I've been working on it for 2.5 years now. And I had that vision of that page. And when I finally finished all the colors and the lighting and everything, it came to be just what I wanted it to be. So I was just in that moment of like just feeling very, very happy with it. And I have to share it, you know. I don't know if you feel like that when you finish a painting.
Yeah. No, it is. Yeah. Especially now it's tough. It's something I've been wrestling with because I've realized how much social media it gives you. It's like a little poke on the back. As soon as I finish something, you know, you're like, oh, I'm excited. I want to share this. So I've actually been doing things where I don't share for a month and I want to get back into gestation.
Yeah.
You know, for me, because I put too many things out way too early and they shouldn't have been released. So I need to hold back. But your stuff's always good, so you don't have that problem. How is the creative process for you with these ideas? Because that's such a different idea with Jukebox.
Yes. So it is. This actually I co-wrote with my husband, who is a record collector.
No
so
way,
part
really?
Of it came,
Nick, right?
Yeah. Yeah, Nick, he has 1,400 records.
Oh, 1,400 I love him already.
Records in our, yes. yeah, I mean, if you ever come back to the Bay, we should, you know, have listen to records and talk art.
Absolutely.
But so I think this idea was like 2010 or 12, in and around the, like, kind of, I was just out of school and we were talking about jukeboxes and, you know, how they only play singles and why. Why can't they play a full album? And then he laughed and he said, because a jukebox that played a full album would have to be humongous. And then it just from that conversation and every other 500 million conversations in our like 17 years of being together about music came kind of flooding together. And I was like, what if there was this gigantic jukebox and it could play full albums? And then, you know, and then we just started talking and the seed of the story was born. Then I ran up to my drawing table and drew in my mind this attic with the jukebox and two girls discovering it. And that was, and I still have that image. I posted it a while ago. And then I remember I told my agent my former agent about it and she was very reserved in any of her reactions. And so I always knew if I told her something and she liked it, that it meant that that was a really good idea. And I remember when I told her, she was like, oh, Nitty, that's good. Whoa. And so, you know, I kind of was like, all right, that will be the next thing that I work on. And what happens for me is that when I'm working on final art, so, you know, making a comic is such a long process. And so when I was working on the final art for Pishmina, it's really at that point, you're a production artist. All the thinking, all the story, all the nuance, all the dialogue, all that stuff is pretty locked down. So you're just kind of making it look pretty. And so I already started thinking about, I was basically working on Jukebox while I was finishing the final art for Pishmina.
Okay.
So, I mean, I'm doing the same thing now. I'm finishing the final art for Jukebox and I'm already planning my next pitch.
Really? Can you talk about your next pitch or no?
No. No. I could tell you if it couldn't go on the podcast, but yeah. So.
Okay, maybe after. Yeah. Oh, Jukebox sounds exciting. Man, these are really amazing. And how much, because now, and how old is your, can I ask about your child? I'm sorry, I don't want to.
No, it's fine. I don't share her name or anything, but yeah, I don't mind talking about it. Yeah, I love my work. I love my family. But man, having her around, it's just like all the stress and anything that I'm concerned about. It's just like, I just love spending time with her because it's not only really sweet, it's hilarious. It's frustrating. It's frustrating to no end most of the time if you're trying to get her to do something. But any other time, it's just great, you know? And that's the, you know, having a family, I think, and, you know, even before her, just being with Nick, it's like those things that keep you going. You know, it's that love. So it's wonderful. It's wonderful to have around.
Did it change for you at all? Because I have to imagine that, because I'm sure the demographic for your work is all over the board, but I would imagine it's mainly younger people. Did having a daughter, does that change the way you look at what you do? Do you feel more responsibility? Does it inspire you more, give you more ideas?
All of the above. I think it's all of those things. I mean, I think my work has always, I've always had kind of this underlying activist, feminist message in my work. And if you've, people who follow my work and know me through my work know that. And I definitely think that I try now more than ever, maybe, I don't know, or maybe it's the same, to make sure that I'm thinking about those things and how I'm choosing to represent women or girls or those relationships, in reinforcing, you know, not trying to reinforce any stereotypes, and really putting out, kind of like strong and powerful women and characters that are also flawed. You know, it's fine for them to also, mess up. And so, yeah, I, kind of on the flip side, she sees my work all the time. She'll come in and check in, you know, sometimes, actually oftentimes after school, when she comes home, we'll sit in my studio and I'll get in like another hour to 45 minutes, depending on how distracting she is, to work. And then she has her own desk here in the studio and she works too, on her art. It's the best. It's the best. And then she'll come and she's too big to sit in my lap while I draw, but she used to sit in my lap while I would draw, like my arms, you know, around her, and I would draw and she would watch me draw.
Oh my God, that's adorable.
And
oh my
now
God.
It's, you know, she just asked me like, can I see what you worked on today? And I show her, and then she just verifies that every single character that even remotely looks like her is her. That's me, right? Yeah, that's me. Yes, they're all you. So yeah, I mean, it's only made everything that I do better.
That is so beautiful. And how, do you mind if I ask, since for you, you were talking about issues with identity with you growing up, how are you approaching that with her?
So one of the things that we think about and talk about a lot, you know, and luckily as an author and an author connected to a lot of people who are making really interesting work is, you know, we make sure that she has books with brown girls in them, you know, that we're choosing media for her that reflects in some way her identity, or at least is inclusive, so that she doesn't feel like she's different in any way. But and again, it's also kind of interesting. We talk about this is a very specific to us situation, which is that she really does. There are books that I have made and that are coming out that are based off of her. And so I kind of feel like she might have the problem of overrepresentation.
You know, like, I see.
You know, like it's kind of an odd situation to realize that this book is me. It's me and my grandmother, or it's me and my aunties. I mean, I kind of feel like it's less of a concern. But at the same time, you know, she's mixed. So that my next pitch, which I still can't talk about, but the main character will be mixed. And then actually one of the girls in Jukebox, she's mixed. She's her dad is white and her mom is Muslim Bangladeshi. So you know, I try to think about those things too, because our representation is still growing, you know, like the things that we're representing in books and media, it's still, there's still a lot of room in there. We feel like, oh, we've reached some, you know, critical mass of, you know, there's a story for everybody. That's nowhere near true. And there's still lots and lots of identities that still get passed over and don't get the space or the opportunity. And so, you know, I try to think about that a lot, or actually I do think about that a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. Imagine having a daughter that just, it's, I mean, increases exponentially for you in terms of importance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
Wow. And, you know, another thing is I remember looking through, like following you for so long that I remember time and time again, I'm like, my God, Nidhi is like the hardest working person I've ever seen. You're like at every comic convention, you're doing tours through schools. Are you still doing a lot of those things?
Yeah, I travel. I would say for a while it was traveling like twice a month. And at the height, before Pashmina came out, I had made myself do two to three at minimum craft fairs or conventions a month. So I was averaging 24 events a year, but it would usually be more than that because around Christmas time, you end up kind of just doing a ton of stuff. So at least in the Bay Area, it's kind of interesting because, you know, I get messages from friends or people that I know and they're like, oh, I went to this, you know, my friend's house and they had, you know, your artwork all up in the walls. And I was like, oh yeah, that's just because you're in the Bay Area. You know, like I've done so many Bay Area events. I don't do them as much now because it definitely, there's an interesting shift that happened for me when I switched from being kind of an illustrator and doing prints and cards and all that kind of stuff to really focusing on storytelling and author work, my events shifted too. So what I was doing before, John, was packing up my merch, you know, in my tiny, at the time, before we got the SUV, like a tiny sedan, and, you know, packing up all these buckets of prints and displays and driving around, you know, upwards to Seattle, you know, and driving down to LA and doing all these shows. So it was a lot of, you know, putting in kind of like that grassroots ground level work and schlepping your stuff to sell it. And it was really grueling and it's exhausting because you spend all that time getting ready and then paying the fees for the shows. And then sometimes you don't break even, you know, but you never know those shows. I have people who followed me from some show I did, you know, in 2012, you know, that I don't even remember. So you never know how, you know, how you build an audience is, it, at least for me at the time, it was a lot of legwork, a lot of trying to get on blogs and all that stuff. And so there was a lot of kind of frustrating, grueling, you know, physical labor that went into doing those things that I said goodbye to when I became an author. Because now if I do events, you know, I just show up. And usually a publisher or a local bookstore or whoever is coordinating it, they have the books on hand. So I come with a flash drive, maybe some business cards, but it's nowhere near as exhausting. It's exhausting in a different way because, you know, in a fair, you're waiting for people to come to you and discover you. In an author situation, people are coming because they like you or because they like whatever subject you're writing about or they're interested.
Yeah, total shift.
Yes, and so they're coming for you and to hear you and take, you know, it takes it's a different kind of toll. It's not a physical toll, it's really a mental toll. I'm like usually just completely wiped after an event now.
Oh, I can imagine, man. I mean, I can't imagine, really.
I'm sure you can. I was curious, as a painter, do you need to be present, like, in the same way? I was always wondering, you know, one of the things I find exhausting about being an author is doing all these events and really having to be the face with the book. Is it the same in the fine art painting world?
I mean, it depends. I don't do, I know some people that, like, if they're doing residency somewhere near colleges or stuff, they'll be speaking to bigger audiences. I don't do anything like that. But to an extent, like art fairs and stuff, it definitely helps. But I've never had to really, you know, have that much engagement with like an audience. It's usually, you know, with a couple of collectors, but it's still important. And of course, like solo shows, like I know artists who don't go to their own solo shows. I'm like, that is ridiculous. You have to be present.
I mean,
it sucks because it took me a while to realize that your artwork is just one component of the package that people are interested in. And actually, in a lot of ways, it's the lesser component, because when people, at least serious collectors, they're investing in you. So it is really important to be present in as many things as possible. I don't know if that's what you're asking.
That is what I'm asking, because I'll tell you what, one of the things that I daydream about is I keep thinking, like, if I get enough kind of passive income that I could take time off. I don't know what, I wonder if other cartoonists or authors have the same kind of daydream, but I daydream a lot to like deal with my stress. And one of my daydreams is to just take 6 months off and do massive, large paintings. And for that 6 month time, not show anybody, kind of like that, like you were talking about gestation, but also liberating myself from needing other people's validation and really painting. I just want a light-filled studio and large canvases. There's just such this, like, I feel like it's like totally an artist's dream to have that light-filled studio and make large paintings and not care whether or not they sell, or, you know, just to make, to really get down to the core of it. I am making art because I enjoy making art, irrespective of, or, you know, independently, without the eyes of other people, and just because I want to see what's going to come out. If I give myself the time and the space and the material, what would happen?
Yeah, like the permission to just put everything else aside. I hope you do it one day. I think it'd be amazing. I'd love to see what you come up with. You know what? I'm surprised. Maybe you have. Because it goes back, I was thinking, and I saw an email a while back, and I think I forgot to respond to you about it. You were asking for a friend about murals. And I was thinking, like, looking at your work, I'm like, have you ever done a mural? Because your work would be amazing at a large scale.
I think that part, so I was just talking to a painter friend of mine who does these large paintings. And I was telling her, you know, I would love to do like maybe some small originals, or maybe I could start getting some mural experience by offering to do commissions in people's homes. And she actually had done that. She had done painting in people's homes. She's like, you don't want to do that.
Yeah.
You don't. She's like, you already have an audience. You could do large paintings right now and sell them. And I looked at her and I was like, you're crazy. That's not true at all. And she was like, no, you're crazy. She's like, you are, because I do Inktober. So I do Inktober, and usually those sketches sell within like the first 5 minutes of me posting them. And so she was, you know, she had followed some of that stuff, and she's like, I think that, yeah, I think that when you go bigger, right, the number of customers is smaller, because that dollar amount is very large. But I think that the idea of doing something large is intimidating, but also I'm kind of curious, like, how? It's just like you're asking me kind of a little bit about the storytelling and comics and everything. I feel that way about fine art. Fine art is this world that I am fascinated by, but I know nothing of.
Right. Well, I think, I could see your work as large paintings. I would have to agree with your friend that I wouldn't do them inside people's homes either. It's kind of like doing commission portraits. They get so picky as they see it come along, and then they see like halfway through and like, are you really going to do that? No. But your stuff, like, I can see more on walls outdoors, you know, and like community-based public work and stuff.
I would love to do that.
I mean, it seems built for it. Yeah.
That's so,
I think so.
So my long-term office manager assistant, who came in to work with me from art school, actually, she went to UC Davis, Nicole. So she was the reason that I emailed you about murals. And it was interesting because she was talking about being interested in, you know, kind of baby steps into at least learning about them and doing them. And as she was talking about it, as we were both talking about it, we both just kind of like revealed to each other that we've always wanted to do large paintings. And so I was telling her, okay, well, I can connect you to anybody that I know who might do it. But also, if you get one of these gigs, like, can I help you if I have time? You know, because like there's just this, I don't know, there's this like fascination with, and actually it's not just a fascination with doing large paintings, but for me, art has always been this thing that I want to be, you know, I'm sure you feel like this too. I always want to give my stuff away for free. And I always want the art to be for everyone and to not have it be cost prohibitive or exclusive or limited in any quantity. And so people have asked me many times, how come you don't do limited editions of your prints? And I always say they're open edition because I don't want to be a barrier. I don't want to create a barrier by me imposing a limit to people accessing something that makes them happy. And that's why I haven't raised my print prices for, I don't even know, like 4 or 5 years. I want it to be accessible. And access has always been something that I think about a lot. And art access is, I think, probably something you probably think about and talk about. You know, that art should be for everyone.
Yeah, I agree. And I feel like it's even more important now, at least from my experience in the U.S. and how it is now, when you're taking art out of schools, you know, some buildings, like they're just nothing. It looks good. It's so much more important to have art accessible to people for homes and outdoors. I mean, that's murals are a great thing. You know, you can give something back to the community.
Yeah, I would love to. I mean, I've seen some like, you know, requests for proposals or whatever, around. But again, I have so many books under contract or, you know, preparing pitches or whatever, that I'm so busy between travel and making books that I'm not sure when that would happen. That's why it's a daydream, that, you know, I'll get enough income that at some point I could say no to everything else and just paint.
Oh, amazing. Lastly, cause I don't want to take up too much of your time. Oh, I'm sorry. What'd you say?
I was going to say, do you feel as a painter that's what you're doing now is like satisfying, that the kind of the artist inside, like what you want to do, is it what you're doing?
Only partially. I'm like you in that I'm trying to find a way to make art more accessible to people, but I think it's really difficult as a fine artist, because if you do too many things that bend towards illustration, then it's kind of frowned upon. You know, there's that weird barrier between illustration and fine art that I think is ridiculous, but it does affect your market.
Yeah.
So I'm not, I like doing gallery work, but I still think for the public, there's a big barrier between the public and the gallery for multiple, you know, reasons. So that's why I started doing murals again. And then I've even been doing these little projects out here where there's a lot of trash in the streets of Paris, found objects. So I take them back to my studio. I'll do paintings on them. And then I leave them out in the street for free. And my way of getting around market and affecting my prices, I just don't sign them. But there would be things there. Some of them would be things I would sell for thousands of dollars in a gallery. And I kind of like that idea of bucking the market that way and making art accessible for free. And then I'll also do prints here and there. So I'm trying to find ways, but I'm not completely satisfied with just doing the gallery thing.
I love that you do that though, with the found objects. That makes me so happy. I love it.
Yeah, it's fun. And sometimes I'll post them and then sometimes I don't. Because I started thinking when I was posting them, I'm like, man, this feels too much like a performance, or I'm still looking for appreciation or some kind of, you know, adulation. So I like doing these things. I'll put them somewhere and then I'll go back and visit and just see if it's gone. And I like this idea that somebody walked across and like, what, can I take this? Holy shit.
So
take it, put it in their house, you know?
So I have a kind of a flip side to that. I was having this conversation with my friend Lila, who I mentioned earlier. Anyways, I can get author copies of my books. And so once a month, I go through this website called Donors Choose. Have you ever heard of it?
No.
So Donors Choose is a website where teachers can kind of raise money for the resources or materials that they need for their classrooms. And so, you know, I mean, just kind of nationally, we're underfunded in our schools. And so teachers end up putting a lot of money back into their classrooms, into their classroom librarians or libraries and art materials and those kinds of things. And so what I do is I go through donors' shoes and I look through and see if anybody's requesting copies of my books. And then we just send them, like once a month, we just send them a package with some prints and some other stuff. And, you know, I sign it to them. And I was talking to my friend Lila about it. And I was like, I don't want to share that. I don't want to share it on social media because I don't want people to congratulate me for doing something that I just feel like is important, you know? And she presented me with the flip side of it, which is what I'm going to share with you. She was like, I actually think that what you're doing is great and could motivate other people to do the same, because it's different than somebody doing it who doesn't have an audience. And you as an audience doing something that is good and kind and giving can inspire other people to do something like that. And I think that you also could do the same for other fine artists that you know, other people. You never know how you doing something good can change somebody and inspire them to do their own version of that. So
I like that. That is a good perspective. Thank you. And so again, I want to keep you too long. I know you're really busy, but I do want to ask, because I feel like when the Pinnacles, when I saw, like, it completely blew my mind one day. We already touched on this, but I want to know the nitty gritty. I log on to Netflix and then I see the Coming Soon for Pashmina.
Yeah. Yeah.
How did that come about? That is so amazing. It's so awesome.
I know. It's kind of still pinch me. Is it real? So the production company, I don't know anything, honestly, about how Hollywood works. It's all kind of a mystery. I have a very tiny bit of information now, being a little bit on the other side. But basically the production company, somebody in the production company read Pashmina, and they liked it. They approached me, myself and my agent, and said, can we shop this around? And that essentially means that they put together a presentation and they take it to a variety of studios and say, we want to make this into a film. And the way that they presented it to us is, so the production company, it has mostly Indian people or Indian Americans in there. And they said, we don't want to, you know, change the story much. And we want to make it not a TV show, not a limited series, but we want it to be a full feature animation because the Indian American community.
Cool.
Yeah. So they were like, we're not going to budge on this. We're not going to accept something else because the Indian American community doesn't have a feature length animated film. We want to be the first. Mm-hmm. And so that's how they went out with it. And from what I heard from them, they went to Netflix with exactly that statement. And Netflix said, yeah,
phenomenal.
I know. It's crazy. And then, you know, they put together
the news. Like, how surreal was that?
I was kind of maybe screaming in my house. I was just, you know, I mean, you get the call and you hear that Netflix wants to make an offer. I mean, backing up, initially when the production company contacted me, you know, they said, we're going to put together, you know, a director, and I can't say who the new involved is because it hasn't been announced yet, but they sent the names to me, and I felt like I was gonna faint. I was like, excuse me, these people are involved? Like, I couldn't handle it, you know. I still kind of am like, oh my god, I can't believe these people are working with something that I created. And then what's happened since is that they haven't crewed up fully yet, but they have hired a visual development person and then somebody else, I think character designer or character, I don't know. But I think the most surreal part of the whole thing was seeing a job listing on Netflix that was like, you know, visual development Pashmina. And I'm sitting there and I remember telling Nicole, you're like, this book that I made is making a job. Like, somebody has a job because I made a book. You know, like, just like, it broke my brain for like the whole day. Because
yeah.
It's just like, that's wild to me. I mean, it's wonderful, but it's not something that I ever, you know, and by the way, I finished final art for Pashmina with a newborn. So my daughter was like, I was stopping in the middle of making final art to pump and like feed her. And I was in like a fugue state because we were getting no sleep. And I remember at that moment, because she was working with me then, she's like, could you imagine going back to that newborn life, Nitty, and saying, you'll make it through and this will become a movie? I'm like, I don't think she would have cared. She would have been like, can you get me more sleep? I'll take more sleep. But yeah, it's all quite wild.
Ah, that's so amazing. Well, congratulations on that. I mean, you kick ass, you're a powerhouse. I mean, it's been amazing to see everything that you've done since we've talked last in that small academy classroom. And yes, it's also been inspirational for me. I mean, seeing what you do has motivated me, you know, in doing things. So thank you for that.
Well, I mean, thank you for what you taught me and everything that you still do. I love seeing all of your work. And I mean, it's mutual.
Oh, thanks, Nitty. Thanks for taking the time to do this. We'll just wrap it up now, but yeah, I really appreciate your time. Lo-Fi Sight and Sound Podcast is an American artist living in Paris, France, in conversation with artists, musicians, and filmmakers discussing context, the creative process, and studio practice. You can find us on all streaming platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. Also at www.lofipodcast.com, no hyphens. Please rate and review. It helps more than you know. If you can't rate and review, then please share this with a friend. Lo-Fi Podcast is recorded, mixed, and edited by myself. Intro music is also by me. Thank you for listening.